You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy anniversary, everyone.
Yeah, this episode is our 12th year anniversary.
What?
My gosh.
Whoa. That is insane.
Yeah, that's a long, long road.
What episode are we up to?
This is 617.
Mm.
49 more episodes will be 666. Yeah.
Yeah, baby.
I was doing some research for a special SGU project. I needed to listen to a few earlier episodes to get a reference on a conversation that I remember that we had.
I love the early episodes.
Oh, my God, Evan, they are so bad. They're so bad.
No.
You know what, Jay, I mean, though? We were stiff. We were all very stiff.
No, we're talking like year one.
Yeah, guys, I'm talking about like episode 20.
Episode 2 and 12.
Yeah, hope there's been a learning curve. I hope we're not just as good now as we were 12 years ago.
Nothing's changed.
It is amazing. And tomorrow, of course, is May the 4th. May the 4th be with you.
Yay.
They're having Star Wars Day at my daughter's school.
Nice.
So they have to bring in Star Wars paraphernalia.
Oh, she's got to be
awesome. Taking a lightsaber. Like, no weapons. What?
It's not a weapon. It's a prop.
I know, but
it's
whatever.
It's a glorified flashlight.
It's a simulated weapon.
Have her bring the hilt only.
Steve, tell me about it. So my son Dylan is just over 4. We went in for like a parent-teacher review, and the teacher was like, we just want to discourage, guns. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, I get like guns, are bad, but like, and she's like, well, sometimes Dylan will like make his hand in the shape of a gun and he'll run around.
Yeah.
And I just looked at her. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? Okay. Yeah. We discourage that. But like, what do you do? Like, what do you mean? You discourage what? Him running around playing? I don't get that. Am I missing something?
No, I agree with you, Jay.
I think you don't give him any attention for it one way or the other.
I know, but the point is, I understand why guns have become a very bad thing in a school setting, but it just made me uncomfortable to think, kids used to run around and like cowboys and Indians. I'm sure you've heard people talk about this. Like, there was a generation where they grew up and it was cowboys and Indians, and then it was after that it was superheroes, and after that it was, Star Wars or whatever.
Well, our favorite game was War. That was the name of the game.
Oh, yeah, War.
We're going to play War where we kill each other. That was our funnest game.
Yeah. Boys are so funny.
Yeah, we used to actually, Kara, we used to get ketchup and bloody ourselves up with ketchup and stage a rumble. So cars would stop and say, hey, you kids, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, we did this. That was so much fun. It was ridiculous. Now, I'm not saying that that's a great thing. Like, in the big scheme of things, I wouldn't want to see my kids doing that.
Times have changed.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm just looking at it like it made me uncomfortable as a parent to think, like, I need to take an action on this. Like, what do I do? I don't know what to do.
Don't point your fingers at other kids.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I have to tell my son now. I don't know. Very, very odd times.
Yeah. Jay, just have him put a fake silencer on his finger and he'll be good.
That's genius.
Let's get started. Kara, what's the word?
So the word this week was actually recommended by Elizabeth Vermeulen, who reached out, I think via Facebook, and told me that she heard it in her biology lecture. And that word is acceptation. Have you guys heard the word acceptation?
Oh, yeah.
Yay. All right. So acceptation is a physical or behavioral feature that has a function for which it was not originally adapted or selected via evolution. So it really falls into line with some of the conversations that we have had on the show about convergent evolution, divergent evolution, like homologous structures. A good example of an exaptation is that a bird or a dinosaur feather likely evolved at the beginning for temperature regulation, but was later adapted for flight. Exaptation in some ways or in some uses is synonymous with the term co-option, as in those feathers were co-opted for flight. You'll often hear writers use it that way. And so the etymology, this is a cool one because it was coined only in 1982 in a paper published by Stephen Jay Gould and Elizabeth Verba. And it was published in the journal Paleobiology. They coined this term as an offered alternative to the longstanding use of pre-adaptation, which really is a teleological argument. We've talked about teleology on the show as well, the argument stands that traits or structures were destined for a specific function. And that's how a lot of paleontologists and evolutionary biologists actually talked about traits. They talked about them being pre-adapted. And so Stephen Jay Gould and Elizabeth Verba said, we need a new word for this. So they started using the term exaptation. It's an amalgamation of ex, meaning out, and adaptation, which can further be broken down into its constituent roots. Ad is towards, and aptare is to fit, as in, you know, apt, the word apt. So this is an out adaptation, and really what we're talking about is all the time this happens in biology, specific things, specific behavior, specific traits, specific morphology being utilized for something other than that which it was originally adapted for. And in a way, because of what we know about evolution, pretty much we can say almost everything was an exaptation because there's so many small gradual changes. And so some biologists don't like the word because they think it doesn't have a clear enough definition. Like, at what point can we call it an exaptation? But some of them still use it.
I think it's an absolutely critical concept of evolution.
Oh my God, yes.
That's the one thing that is almost universally missing from creationist nonsense. Like, how could half a wing be useful? Because they weren't using it for flying.
Yeah. You know,
and it totally has this hindsight bias of it was evolving towards a wing. No, it wasn't. It was just what it was, and they were using it for whatever they were using it for. And, you know, nature is messy. Reality is messy. You can use things for other purposes other than the thing for which it was. You know, how many times have I used a screwdriver as a hammer because I don't have a hammer?
Yeah.
You know, just whatever. Right. It's not a great hammer, but it gets the job done. That's just the way it is. Anyway, yeah, acceptation. That's a very key concept. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, Jay. This isn't the first time I heard this about an exercise in a pill. Is this something even interesting? What's going on here?
I think it is interesting. This particular study has some meat to it that I haven't heard before, but let's get into it and we'll talk a little later about what you think. So in a recent study that appears in Cell Metabolism, that's a journal, Salk Institute scientists have figured out what chemical would trigger a gene pathway in mice that would mimic the beneficial effects of exercise. So this includes fat burning and stamina. So before I get into the details of this, I want to acknowledge that I've seen a ton of these news items, like Steve said, and, you know, talking about some type of pill replacing exercise, or, you know, you wake up and you're, you know, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, if they make a pill where you could wake up, be as big as Arnold and have an Austrian accent, I'll consider taking it. That would be pretty cool. So I don't think that we're really talking about a pill that's going to completely replace physical exercise or movement here, but they're saying that they've discovered a chemical that can help improve stamina. So this one is pretty damn interesting. So take a look at this. The scientists start with this question: how does endurance work? This is where their starting point was. They want to know, you know, how does endurance work in biologically in our cells? So to be more accurate, they want to know, you know, what genes play a role in endurance? What gets triggered when someone is exercising? What genes are turned on and off, or what's going on? So as people train and they become more fit, something interesting happens. Their muscles shift from using carbohydrates for energy to using fat. And researchers made the assumption that endurance is tied to the body's ability to use fat as an energy source. Previous studies by other labs found that a gene called PPARD, and this was tied to the answer, when they genetically engineered mice to have the PPARD gene permanently activated, the mice were super fit, resistant to weight gain, and highly responsive to insulin. All of the qualities are part of what makes someone physically fit. The research team found a chemical called GW1516 that activated the PPARD gene just as if the subject were doing physical exercise. So after they gave the GW1516 chemical to normal, unmodified mice, they showed the same physical traits, the resistance to weight gain and the responsiveness to insulin, as the modified mice. The one thing that the GW1516 chemical did not do was it didn't actually affect the mice's endurance, though. So it improved their resistance to weight gain and their responsiveness to insulin, but it didn't have anything to do with endurance. So what the Salk team did was they gave the GW1516 chemical to the mice for a longer period of time. They doubled the amount of time. Instead of 4 weeks, they gave them the chemical for 8 weeks. And their test was to give the compound to a bunch of lazy-ass mice. The technical term is sedentary mice. and for the control, they did not give the chemical to these other lazy mice, right? And they found that when they had both sets of mice run on a treadmill until they couldn't run anymore, those mice who didn't receive the chemical could run 160 minutes. How long do you think that the drugged mice could run?
260 minutes.
270 minutes. A 70%.
Ooh, I'm good.
Yeah, that was very good. A 70% longer than the untreated mice. And that is 100% due to the fact that they were given the GW1516 chemical for 8 weeks. They found that the mice were exhausted when their blood sugar levels dropped to about 70 milligrams per deciliter. And this suggested that when someone has low glucose levels, their fatigue sets in. That's when you feel fatigue, when your glucose level drops down to below that mark. Now, I don't know how true this all is because I'm tired all the time and I eat like a pig. So I don't get how this works. but it's apparently that's what the scientists are saying. So what is happening on the molecular level? This is the really cool part. The scientists found that in the mouse's muscles, 975 genes had their expression changed, either becoming increased or suppressed, right? So what they're saying here is when they gave them this drug, 975 genes either turned on or turned off. Those genes that were increased regulated breaking down and burning fat for energy. And those that became suppressed were in charge of breaking down carbohydrates for energy. So there's a simple conclusion to draw here. The PPARD gene prevents carbohydrates from being burned as energy during exercise, which means that you burn fat when you exercise. Now, and that would lean heavily towards being, you know, weight gain resistant. When your muscles are automatically going to burn fat for fuel instead of burning the glucose that they have access to, you're burning your fat stores and you're losing weight. So this means that the PPARD pathway prevents sugar from being an energy source in the muscles during exercise. What they're saying is that this is possibly to preserve sugar for the brain because your brain likes to use sugar for its energy source. And, you know, during a combative moment, you need your brain to really be sharp in order to get out of danger or whatever. It's kind of, you know, we evolved to have that glucose available for your brain and not have it be burned up by your muscles. There are diabetics that could benefit from medication like this. I mean, there's the list of things that they said, it was pretty cool. And it seems to me like, you know, this would start with helping people that have these conditions. And then, you know, it could start by helping people that are older, just be, you know, feel like they have more energy. And then it probably be available to a lot of other people, especially if there are no bad side effects. I mean, I can't see why anyone wouldn't want this.
But yeah, we're talking, this is like 10 to 20 years away.
Sure.
If it pans out. A lot of variables here about whether or not this will pan out. Most new promising things like this don't pan out. So there's a lot of unknowns that have to be sorted out. The exercise in a pill is a trope that it just doesn't apply to this. And I hate, that's one of those things that I think is bad science journalism. You know what I mean? This is one aspect of the metabolic changes that occur, you know, with building up of endurance, and that maybe this can be exploited, you know, medically to have some benefits. But I think it's really misleading to call it exercise in a pill. All right, guys, let me ask you a question. When do you think humans or our human ancestors, hominins, first arrived in the Americas in North and South America.
15,000 years ago.
122,000 years ago.
One of those dates.
So somewhere in between.
Yeah, so we don't know for sure, but the real question here, which is fascinating, is how do we know? So,
so it was a trick question. Thanks.
There's different... No, no, we are going to answer this question, but that's the interesting bit. You can't answer one question without the other. So obviously, smoking gun evidence of human beings in the Americas is pretty clear, right? So that would be a skeleton, you know, fossil remains, actual pieces of people. They obviously had to be here if they were fossil remains. The oldest fossil remains that we have go back 14,000 years.
Not long.
In the Bering Strait. So that's the that's the oldest, unequivocal, everyone agrees, yep, that's a person. They were in North America. It was, and then, you know, obviously the dating has to be reliable as well. We have multiple dating methods, and in that case, yeah, the dating to 14,000 years is very reliable. So that's solid archaeological evidence.
Well, what about tools? I mean, that would be damn solid evidence too, if you define tools or weapons that only people would make.
So that's the next level of evidence, Bob. You're correct, that is unequivocal signs of occupation, but not the bones themselves. So that would be, you know, the best thing there would be clear cut tools, right? So rocks that were crafted into tools or weapons, and in a way that absolutely required, you know, a human being. So not just a rock used as a tool, but like, you know, flaked off and put an edge on and hafted, whatever.
Spear points, right.
Yeah, like it's like a typical arrowhead, like stone arrowhead, that where clearly somebody made that. So finding them, and there's also other things, like you could find the remains of, yeah, potter is always nice, but that's, you know, it's not clear how far back that goes. Stone tools are going to go back farther. But, you know, huts, like finding like the places where they had a fire pit and maybe a foundation or something. So there might be other things too that you could find that are other than weapons and tools that are pretty clear. So there is that kind of evidence going back 24,000 years, but that evidence is not universally accepted. The ones going back 24,000 years, it's probable evidence of occupation, but there's still some question about that. So that's the range, 14 to 24,000 years, first evidence of people on this side, on the America's side of the Bering Strait.
So I was only 100,000 years over. Okay, continue.
Well,
that's right. Okay, now there's also, if you go one notch below that, there's equivocal evidence of tools, of artifacts, right? So maybe stones that could have been used as tools, and they might have marks on them, but they weren't clearly shaped by people. And the other thing is bones that were processed and then fossilized. So if you use a stone tool in order to scrape meat off of a bone to eat it, right, to cook it, to process it, that leaves clear marks on the bone that are diagnostic. You know, you could look at them under the microscope and say, yeah, somebody scraped this bone with a stone. And while it was fresh, you know, while there was meat on the bone. So it wasn't just damage that happened to the bones after the corpse rotted away. Those are pretty good evidence, but that's not smoking gun evidence, because a lot depends on, well, how clear are the marks on the bone, and how clear are the wear marks on the stone tools, and are they in relation to each other? You know, so that's a little bit in the gray zone. It depends on, you know, how much everyone agrees that, yeah, those are clear stone marks on the bones. Okay, so reason why I'm going through all this is because a recent study that was published claims to move the date for the earliest people in the Americas from this 24,000 year date to 130,000 years.
Which is a big jump.
Yeah, Jay. Good job.
Evan, write that down.
Which would be done. Massive. But what kind of evidence do they have for a human occupation for 130,000 years? It's the weakest kind of evidence. It's
not
the
much.
Weakest.
Well, it would have
so to, what yeah. they have is mastodon bones that are broken up and rocks. They think that there's evidence that those rocks were used to deliberately break up the bones.
They think.
They think.
What about an avalanche?
That's the problem is that, you know, there may be other ways that bones could get smashed apart by rocks, you know, with that didn't involve people doing it deliberately. So these are not worked stones, right? They have not been reshaped. They're not clearly human artifacts. They're just rocks. The researchers say, yeah, but you could see there's some wear marks here that could have been from using these rocks as a tool. Very dubious evidence. And also they were kind of in the same place, you know. But there's no human bones there. There's no evidence that, you know, direct evidence that there were humans there. You know, some people say, yeah, but these rocks don't really belong here. So they're kind of out of place. And so therefore somebody might have brought them there. But it's interesting because it all reminds me of our discussion from last week about the historicity of Jesus, because it's ultimately based upon an argument from ignorance. That they can't think of another way that these rocks and these bones sort of got there in that state. So maybe people did it, but there could be all sorts of ways, you know, because we're just talking about rocks and broken bones. You know, there isn't any clear-cut evidence of human activity.
Yeah.
And that's basically the consensus of the scientific community in response to this evidence. They're like, eh. Okay, this is interesting. I'll grant you that there's some mildly interesting evidence here, but this is really far from us changing the date. Now, this is also an extraordinary claim, not impossible, but I mean, that leaves a 100+ thousand year gap of no evidence of people in the Americas. And also, you go back 130,000 years, you're talking about Neanderthals probably, not even modern humans.
I mean, it could be. It could have been impossible to know.
Could have been archaic humans or Neanderthals. You would expect that if there was human occupation 130,000 years ago, we would find something a little bit more impressive because, you know, hey, people did have crafted tools. There was a toolkit at that time. They were flaking off their stone tools, you know. Doesn't mean they couldn't just pick up a rock to smash some bones, but that we would expect to see some more convincing evidence. And, you know, if there was any occupation, at some point we got to find bones. Right, we got to find some fossils.
And Steve, you know, it because it doesn't sound like it was that long ago, why aren't there bones?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you could argue that, well, maybe it was a brief occupation. They came across, they were here for a couple of thousand years and they died out. And then we had nothing for 100,000 years until the next, you know, wave of modern humans came across. So you'd almost have to argue that. But again, it's sort of an argument from a lack of evidence. You know, it's not really very compelling. At the end of the day, you need positive evidence to establish something. So, you know, again, this is not impossible. It'd be fascinating, you know, if there were previous migrations of hominins into the Americas. I'm very definitely fascinated with that. The whole question of the first peopling of the Americas and who were they? Where'd they come from? You know, was it the same people or were there subsequent, you know, migrations? It's all really, really very fascinating. I just think this is the really thin, very thin line of evidence. And I don't think it's going to stand up. But we'll see. You know, we'll see.
Let's find more and keep looking.
This is not going to be resolved with the current evidence. I don't think anyone's going to really buy this with the current evidence. You're going to need to find me the bones of the people who did this, you know, and then we'll talk. All right, Kara, I understand that even cancer can evolve.
Yeah, so there's a new piece in The Atlantic by Ed Yong where he highlights the story of Laura Breeley, which is not her real name, a woman who was affected with lung cancer. She, like many others, thought that she had it conquered, and after removing the tissue and having radiation and chemotherapy, she was in the clear, but then about a year later, it came back with a vengeance. And this is a common story, I think, that all of us have heard when we've lost loved ones to cancer, that they kicked it, and then it came back full force. Her oncologist, Charlie Swanson, thinks that this is because of the evolutionary nature of cancer. It seems counterintuitive because everything we know about Darwin's evolution via natural selection has to do with species, has to do with whole organisms like animals and plants and bacteria and fungi. But cancer is just we've always thought that cancer is just our own body cells kind of errantly dividing because the mechanisms to keep them in check has mutated beyond control. But it's a little bit more than that. And I think the key word there is mutation. So it's not just our own healthy cells that can mutate in the cancer process. They, of course, go through a series of revisions until our tumor suppressor genes and our tumor suppressor genes no longer work and our oncogenes work a little bit too well. But once those cells become cancerous, the cancerous cells themselves mutate. It doesn't stop just because a tumor forms. There's no like end state of cancer other than death. So that's really when all hell breaks loose, is when the cancer cells themselves start to mutate beyond control. And a typical tumor is made up of oftentimes a lot of different kinds of cells that are at different rates of mutation. And that's not the conventional wisdom. We often think of a tumor as a solid mass of a very particular kind of cell. That's why we name cancers certain things, and they're based on the cell type that make up the tumors. But the truth of the matter is, within that individual tumor, some cells might be growing and spreading more quickly than others. They're all competing for different nutrients, but only some of them will win. So those cells that are the most metastatic will start to dominate, and that disease state will be really spiraled into something more deleterious. Yang, in his piece, points out that it's this very nature of cancer that makes it so hard to conquer. Usually, cancer is first diagnosed based on a single biopsy, but that sample might miss cells that are lurking literally millimeters away that have a completely different mutation and offer a different prognosis. In fact, just like antibiotics selecting for superbugs, the treatments that we often use that are less targeted, like chemo or radiation, may be inducing artificial selection among cancer cells because they kill off the weaker mutants and they leave the strongest DNA to divide and conquer. And even though this idea was first noted by Peter Nowell, a cancer researcher, in a paper he published in Science in 1976. The idea didn't really catch on until around 2010, when scientists like Mel Greaves started studying the evolutionary aspects of leukemia. And now, of course, whole conferences are dedicated to this research. But what they did was a really interesting study that I've pulled up here. Actually, it was a two-part study, but I'll just talk about the first part that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And there's literally, I can't even read, like 50 authors on this paper, maybe more. It was the Tracer X Consortium. And they took multiple individuals who had lung cancer, and they decided to, no, kidney cancer, I apologize. And they decided to look at their individual cancers and their individual tumors and really start to pull apart what was happening in them. They've seen this in leukemia, they've seen this in kidney cancer, and they've seen this in lung cancer. And they started to notice something that they could actually point to as sort of an evolutionary tree within the cancer itself, where there are these like trunk tumors, as they call them, and then there are these branch tumors, or the tumor itself has a trunk portion and a branch portion. And you can physically see the mutations as they become more and more specialized. The more specialized they become, the harder it is to knock them out based on these pinpoint treatments that we've developed, this genetic cancer medicine. So what researchers are now finding is that the more they can target the trunk and the more that they can do that early on in the treatment process, the more likely they are to wipe out the cancer as a whole. Although most oncologists still say that there's no such thing as a treatment or a cure, or I should say they still say there's no such thing as a cure for cancer. Oftentimes this is just trying to stay one step ahead of it. There's a great quote in here by Robert Gattenby from the Lee Moffitt Cancer Center. He said, it's chess. It's not whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. And so a new approach that's coming out lately, which has its problems, but maybe promising. You really can't biopsy a tumor over and over and over and over in a person. It's incredibly invasive. But the problem is, if you're basing all of your cancer treatment based on a biopsy that was done months, years, maybe even weeks ago, you're not really getting out in front of the cancer as it stands today. And so there are some new experiments and new treatments being done with something called circulating tumor DNA, ctDNA, which is really a fragment of the DNA that gets released into a person's bloodstream when their cancer cells die. And so they're kind of calling this like a liquid biopsy. And they're able to look at this quote unquote liquid biopsy to see where their cancer is evolving. Now, they know they're not probably right ahead of it, but it's closer than historically we've been with having to look at old biopsy information in order to come up with a new targeted treatment. So that could be one way that using this new information about cancer evolution can provide better treatments in the future. And then other ways are just to really focus on these genetic treatments that target specific DNA sequences that are really targeting what they call these trunk cells instead of these branch cells, if that makes sense. You can kind of visualize a tree. And just like the evolutionary tree, there's more specificity the closer you get to the sort of limbs, the tips of the limbs. So those different approaches combined could be ways to curb evolution. But of course, most oncologists still think that the best way to quote unquote treat cancer is to prevent cancer. And so a multi kind of pronged approach is probably the best that we see on the horizon. But it's interesting. It's a whole new paradigm and it's only recently really caught on.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Do you remember, this was before your time, Kara, but the other guys, remember when Michael Ignor actually made the argument that if evolution were true, then like if you got brain cancer, the brain cancer should be, why doesn't it evolve into a better brain?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, well, the cancer evolves into better cancer.
Yeah, that's right. Or, that's what he meant.
Yeah, by its standards.
It's evolving. It's evolving. It's treatment resistant. Doing what it does. It evolves into a more aggressive cancer. Exactly. Totally doesn't understand how evolution works.
Wow.
But anyway. Yeah, I think this is you know taking it to that next level of really understanding how this you know disease changes over time. It's a dynamic process. You say it's not like once it becomes a tumor, that's it, it stops changing. No, it's only in
hyperdrive at that point. And as Ed Yong points out in the piece, like he interviews a lot of researchers in this piece, and many of them say that when this all started to come into vogue amongst cancer researchers. Like used to be there was a tiny room at a conference and only a few researchers would show up for talks in this area and eventually whole conferences became dedicated to it. And as it became sort of known and understood, at first people got super depressed because they're like, oh my God, this is more complicated than we ever thought it was before. How are we ever going to approach this? But now there's sort of a newfound optimism amongst oncologists and researchers because they're like, gosh, at least we know what's happening. And now we have all these new tools and all these new ways to approach this from an angle where we try to be at least one step ahead instead of always being 10 steps behind. So, it's a cool transition where on its surface, I think it sounds like a huge bummer talking about this. But the truth of the matter is, I think we're just going to have better, more specialized and more effective treatments coming out of this research.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, to finish up the news segment, unfortunately, we have some sad news. Our friend David Young, who is the founder of the Hong Kong Skeptics, we talked about him last year. He was diagnosed with ALS. He has a familial form of ALS. His father died of familial ALS, and he learned that he had it. It's a muscle wasting disease where you just get weaker and weaker until you essentially can't breathe. Unfortunately, David died last week. He had gone home to spend time with his family in Canada. And he died there while with family and friends. Definitely, a huge loss for the skeptical community. Very, very tragic. He was really just at the peak of his life, unfortunately. Often that's how ALS works, it could hit people, right in the prime of their life. Very sad.
She was.
Yeah. So we talked about David previously on the show. We actually, said that he is a, forgotten superhero of science. As far as skepticism goes, David, my opinion, was a pioneer. He was in Hong Kong. He was working in a place that was very difficult to start grassroots skepticism. He built a community. He started bringing people in for lectures. Then he started lecturing. Just a fantastic person, very intelligent and very forward-thinking and very aggressive in his desire to spread critical thinking. And I do think that David left a very strong and lasting impact on the community in Hong Kong. And I really do hope that those people still continue the work that he started. Mm-hmm. It's always sad when we lose a friend like this. It's also sad that you know, the work that he would have done isn't going to happen now. But you know, what can we do? You know, there really isn't anything that we could do. We could remember our friends. We could talk about the work that they did, and just try to keep doing the work ourselves until we run out of time.
So, Jay, there is something you could do, actually. So David's family has actually made a request. So his grandmother, every year for a while, raises money for ALS research. And over the past 8 years, she's raised $30,000 Canadian for ALS research. And they're hoping to get the word out this year and maybe raise that same amount in 1 year, essentially in David's honor. So if you want to donate in David Young's honor to ALS research, we will provide the link where you could do that in his name. That will be in the show notes. It's way too long a URL to say, but we'll have the link available. And if you can't find it, whatever, just email us. We'll send it to you. Well, Jay, we're going to move on. Get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, last week I played this noisy.
All right. What is that?
I like it.
Buck Rogers movie.
So, I can name that tune in three
from
notes.
The 80s.
That's right, Bob. Remember? That totally sounds like it. So I picked this noisy originally because it completely reminded me of like video game sounds, right? You guys?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Like, a lot of like the stand-up arcade, you know, coin-op video games that I played a lot of growing up. And you could hear, like, you know, just even like in the part where it's like bop bop bop, like it kind of almost sounds like Pac-Man too. There's a lot of noises in there that are just in my DNA. So this noisy is actually from an oscilloscope. Did that hint help you in any way?
So did they just plug it up to a speaker?
Well, listen, but it's tied to the oscilloscope because. I'll tell you what, I will tell you what this is by reading the winner from last week. Last week's winner is Edvard Grodem. He says, hi, fellow skeptical clusters of atoms. Thank you for delivering a great show every week. I think that's the sound of some very cleverly designed music. When played on a speaker, it sounds like what we hear on ESGU. But if you put the same wave on an oscilloscope, a creative movie appears, which moves to the rhythm of the music. The right channel determines the position of the x-axis, and the left channel determines the position of the y-axis. So there are people that create sounds that will make a picture on the scope.
I love that.
Now, the piece that I played was from a track called Planets, by Jeroboam Fenderson. When you look at this song being played on the scope, it actually makes pictures. And that's the trick. The trick is that he's able to make pictures and have the music, which is making the pictures, right? It's just fascinating. And the thing that's really cool is when you look at the pictures, they completely look like early computer graphics. So they're reminiscent.
Well, yeah, because an oscilloscope only has like a grid. You can't do too much with it.
No, it's right.
It's
going to
look super lo-fi. Yeah.
Yeah. So the graphics look like video games from the 80s and they sound like video games from the 80s. It's all wrapped in. It's like wrapped in together. It's very, very, very cool. I loved it. Absolutely love it. So moving on. My only hint for this noisy is that a ton of people over the last couple of years have asked me to play this sound. And I thought, why not pull it out? Because I found a version of it that is a little offbeat, but I think the people that have sent it in might recognize it. This is a cool sound. Let me know what you think.
I don't like it.
You didn't like that?
I don't like that sound.
Made you uncomfortable?
Well, it sounds like a weapon.
Sounds like the dentist's office.
Evan, I will say that your guess has a little bit of something to it. Anyway,
okay.
If you think you know what it is, and please, if you've heard anything cool, noises at your work, something outside, whatever, email me that noisy. to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Okay, thanks, Jay. Hey, we have a great interview coming up with Mark Rondazza on free speech. But before we get to that, Jay, Nexus coming up. What's going on?
Guys, we have a great lineup for Nexus this year. In particular, our keynote speaker at Nexus this year, Steve, who is it?
Yeah, Mike Massimino. He's a former NASA astronaut. You may recognize him from The Big Bang Theory if you watch that show. He's been on a couple episodes. Very interesting guy. Love talking to people who've been to space. I can do that.
Not only that, Steve, he was the first person to tweet from space.
Yeah.
And I believe he was the last person to work on the Hubble telescope. So here are some cool facts about Mike. Mike is currently an engineering professor at Columbia University and has been the senior advisor for space programs at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum since 2014. And in line with that cool fact, he is a New Yorker, which is very cool. During graduate school at MIT, Mike worked on human operator control of space robotics, which eventually led him to work on displays for the remote manipulator arm at NASA. Guys, and Steve's right. He was on The Big Bang Theory, and he's been further away than any other astronaut on the space station due to his work on the Hubble.
Wow.
Yep.
So, very cool.
Mike is going to be our keynote, and he is just a really, really cool guy with tons of stories, and I think you'll love to hear him go. But listen to this, guys. Nexus, man, we've got how many speakers this year, Steve? We've got 30 people coming to
Over
Nexus
30,
to speak. So Nexus is from June 29th to July 2nd. So we have workshops on that Thursday. We have SBM all day on Friday. And then Saturday and Sunday, we have the general programming with all the other speakers. We have a ton of nighttime events going on. There's going to be skeptics in the pub, a lot of things to do. It's going to be wonderful. Last year, we had an awesome, awesome conference last year, and we'd make improvements every year. So please come to Nexus. Go to nexus.org, NECSS.org.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, The Great Courses Plus.
You guys, you know that we are lifetime learners here on the SGU, and that's why we continue to be really big fans of The Great Courses Plus, because you get unlimited access to stream their entire library of great video lectures from award-winning experts in all different topics.
The Great Courses Plus has an amazing, a whopping 8,000 lectures to choose from. You can listen to a different one every day and maybe until you die. New ones are added all the time, and you could also watch on your schedule from any smartphone, tablet, laptop, TV, or tricorder.
Recently, we've been watching The Remarkable Science of Ancient Astronomy. This is actually a really interesting course because it goes over what we actually know about ancient astronomers. For example, how does our knowledge of ancient astronomy apply to Stonehenge or the Great Pyramids at Giza and things like this? Very interesting.
We want you to sign up for the Great Courses Plus right now with our special URL, and you will immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of the lectures. So you sign up today at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. We are joined now by Mark Rondazza. Mark, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much.
So, full disclosure, Mark is my attorney. He's representing me in that pesky lawsuit that we're going through. But, Mark, you are also an internationally recognized expert on freedom of speech. Is that fair to say?
My mom thinks so.
Has she ever traveled out of the country?
She hasn't, but she knows people who have, and she's very impressed with me.
Close enough.
So, a couple weeks ago, we were talking about the whole Alex Jones hubbub. And interestingly, you were recently interviewed on InfoWars, although it was not you were not with Alex Jones. You were with one of the other hosts on that channel.
But definitely achievement unlocked.
Level up.
How did that go?
You know what? It went great. I mean, I've done a lot of media, I've done Fox News, I've done CNN, and when I go on to those, it's always either hostile or stupid or some combination of the two, you know, and you're just trying to make sure that, you know, cause the interviewer is almost always either trying to make you look bad or trying to make you make some vacuous point that makes no sense. And it's like, boy, if I can just get out of this interview without making an idiot of all these people watching me, not much less myself, I'm happy. And the interviewer was fantastic. I mean, I was blown away at how thorough he was, interested in the issues he was, and not really trying to make a lot of drama about it. So it was my preconceived notions were completely washed away.
Yeah, I watched the interview. I thought it was fine. But I don't think that your opinions were far off of his opinions, you know, so it wasn't really that much confrontation there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, but I mean, I certainly did go at some of the InfoWars sacred cows, right? You know, the whole... Let's face it. They are home to some extremely bizarre mm-hmm. theories. You know, nothing so bizarre as, you know, you can inject arthritis medication near your spine and tilt you upside down and cure, the bubonic plague. But,
yeah, crazy. You know,
but, you know, some crazy stuff, you know, the Sandy Hook was an inside job and, you know, and I mean, that just, I guess anything's possible. We all have to be skeptical, but I'm not buying that. And I find that opinion's kind of offensive, but hey, this is America and you have a right to say it and a right to have the crazy theories that you want to have.
There's a couple things I want to talk about. You know, we'll talk about just the whole free speech thing for a minute, but before we get to that, let's revisit our conversation about Alex Jones and the fact that his attorney claimed in a custody battle that he is a performance artist and he doesn't really believe the things he says on his show on InfoWars. So, you know, how much, first of all, do you buy that argument? And how much does that insulate him, or does that open him up to, does that insulate him from libel and slander? If he could just say, hey, it's all a performance art. I mean, tell us give us your thoughts on that.
It doesn't insulate him if that's what he thinks, but nobody else thinks it. I mean, if that's true, it definitely restores a certain percentage of my faith in humanity. You know, but if his story is, look, I'm just the Stephen Colbert that was on the Colbert Report, and nobody's really taking this seriously, that can help him. But because in a defamation case, what the reader or listener hears and takes away from it matters. So I could make, you know, some statement on here that, you know, I saw you with John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe snorting cocaine off a hooker's ass in downtown Hartford. It would be defamatory if anybody would believe it, right? So it's such an outrageous thing to say. Now, is Alex Jones's statements, does he make so many outrageous statements that no one takes anything he has to say seriously? Because there actually is a crackpot defense to defamation.
Yeah. Isn't that the Larry Flint? Isn't it the Larry Flint defense in a way?
Well, no, there was a defense in to a case. Well, yes, there was a case where Larry Flint got sued for calling Andrea Dworkin a shit squeezing sphincter, and so they said. Yeah, Andrea Dworkin got a little thin-skinned about that, and they said, well, you know, nobody's going to take that seriously that you've actually said that she's a, you know, a certain anatomical part that expels waste. And then there was a shock jock case out of the Ninth Circuit where, you know, these guys on a morning radio show said some outrageous things. I can't remember the facts of it, but they, you know, everybody said, look, it's morning drive time radio. Nobody's going to take this stuff seriously. Therefore, it isn't capable of being defamatory. So, you know, if Alex Jones wants to kind of torpedo his own credibility that way, it could insulate him. But in the case that's been filed against him, as I mentioned when I was on InfoWars, is one of the paragraphs alone in the complaint does set this up, that he makes all these outrageous claims that are completely unbelievable. So nobody should take him seriously except for this statement in this case. And I think that's a, you know, that's really not a well thought out defamation claim. If that's how you're going to go at it, you need to go at it with, hey, a lot of people listen to this guy and take what he has as gospel.
Which I think is true. I mean, I do think there's a lot of people out there who believe everything he says.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, let me ask you a question. In your opinion, do you think he's playing a character?
I do. I really do. Because, you know, some of his antics are just completely outrageous.
Calculated.
Yeah, I mean, I would say my guess in my, you know, I've never met the man, I've never talked to the man, but I have watched some of his videos, and I think at least sometimes he is playing a character, you know, but other times he's a really serious and good interviewer. If you've never seen it, there's an episode where he interviews Louis Farrakhan, and it's two episodes of it, and you know, talk about two guys that I think are performance artists, but it very quickly became this really intellectually gripping interview. And I was really fascinated by the interplay with these two guys that you wouldn't expect to be able to sit in the same room without exploding if they shook hands. But it was, wow. It was really, really worth the time to sit there and watch.
Mark, I interpret that kind of like you're saying, this guy seems to be savvy. And he has to be somewhat intelligent in order to do what you're describing. And I do, you know, I agree with you. I think he is hamming it up. At the very least, he's hamming it up. Because I said when we talked about this on the show a few weeks ago, I was saying, you know, this guy is aware of his audience and he's aware of what they respond to and he's giving them what they want. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he's not the only, you know, there are a lot of media personalities. I mean, I'm not going to reveal any confidences, but I've got a number of friends who are well known in the media, and the majority of them are a different person when the camera comes on.
But isn't there a difference between claiming that it's satire, you know, like the Stephen Colbert argument, and a lot of things are protected as satire, right? Comedy, you know, they can make false claims all the time because it's meant to be funny. But isn't there a difference between that and playing a character basically where you are acting as a charlatan?
Well, the question is, how does the audience see it? And I think that's where, you know, that's where I don't know how, you know, I don't know how far Jones can take that. Now, in his divorce, his custody case, you know, I don't know. I mean, for him to say, I'm really just playing a part there, I don't know why that's even relevant in a custody case. You know, what a guy does on camera shouldn't matter. In the defamation case, though, that's been filed against him, I think it's another story. But the plaintiff there alleged the lack of credibility. For him to raise it himself, you're right. I mean, because was it a well? Heck, didn't Trump sue Stephen Colbert because he made some bet with him that he didn't follow through on? Mm. Or no,
didn't
I'm sorry.
Surprise me.
It was Bill Maher. Bill Maher like laid out some challenge, and Trump sued him to follow through on it.
Okay,
but that's a comedy show, so he can't pull that off.
That's how I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah,
there is a difference. Just as a matter of, you know, take off my lawyer hat and put on my media criticism hat. I think a show like InfoWars, if you are doing it as performance art, it's kind of a blurry line because you're really not playing the Stephen Colbert character with the Eagles flying around and all the over the top patriotism stuff. You know, and you're not Vermin Supreme who's playing, you know, the extreme, you know, if he gets elected, everybody gets a pony thing. you know, some people take you seriously and some people don't. And, you know, I don't know how the law would look at that. I haven't seen many cases where you have that. Depending on who your jury is, right? You could have six people on that jury who would look at it and say, nobody takes this guy seriously. Come on. We sit around and we do drinking games about him. I mean, you know, I know people who sit around and just watch it for entertainment value and it doesn't matter, you know, and it's like, why are you watching this? It's like, 'cause it's hilarious. But then there are people who sit there.
We also know people who watch it and who believe every word and who go into this alternate reality. So
oh,
how do you decide how many people, what percentage of the people
that's
have
it,
to believe
look
it
at,
before
right, Steve, because look
real.
At Colbert. Look at Colbert, because there were a subset, a small, credulous subset of people who believed everything he said. And
yeah, but
really
there's a
him.
Difference there, Bob. Colbert explicitly says on camera that he's doing a character, and in the commercial breaks, he flips into his real persona. Like, there, it's always been explicit and there's always been a disclaimer there. But like, take somebody like Ann Coulter, where you could argue, is she capitalizing? She doesn't actually believe this, but she knows the audience is going to buy the book, so she's going to keep peddling it. Or does she actually think all the crazy things she thinks? That's a really, I think, blurrier line, no?
Ann Coulter, what you see is what you get.
That's so scary. Her defense,
on a recent interview, her defense was not that it's fake, but that it was a quote-unquote rhetorical flourish.
Whatever that means.
So, like, yeah. If she says, oh, I don't think women should be able to vote, she doesn't necessarily mean that women literally shouldn't be allowed to vote. She's making a rhetorical statement about, you know, women's politics or whatever. That's her defense.
That's terrible.
In terms of, yeah, but for me, again, even bigger than the defamation issues here are just the communication, the journalism issues here. So we're living in a world where nothing's real, where all the lines are blurred, deliberately blurred, impossible to tease apart blurred. And I mean, look at our president. That's basically how the guy functions. When he says things, it's like, well, I don't literally mean the words that I say. I just sort of mean some vague sort of concept related to the words.
Tries to have it both ways.
And you should know that. Yeah.
The world did go a little crazy, you know, at some point. Whatever matrix we're in, the subroutine that runs the onion leaked into everything.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. That is the best freaking description.
Yeah, but you know, if you study the history of American media, it's not, I don't know, maybe it's just as depressing as I think the five of us are making it out to be, or maybe it isn't. But you know, from the earliest days of American media, it was all fake news. Mm-hmm. You know, the party papers. I mean, the so-called newspapers around the time of the revolution in the early 1800s were nothing but defamation rags going at the other party. I mean, you think Ann Coulter is partisan and harsh and shrill? You know, you think that even the Huffington Post is rough, or Rachel Maddow is if you happen to be on the right wing, I'm sure Rachel Maddow sounds like the same nails on the chalkboard that Ann Coulter or Alex Jones do. That's nothing. That's kumbaya civility compared to what, you know, what people were dealing with in the early days of the country when, frankly, the founding fathers were publishing these things. Mm-hmm. And then literally locking each other up or trying to criminalize that speech. So it's not that bad. It's just, you know, we're coming out of I would say that most people would probably say the golden age of journalism, you know, maybe the high water mark was, you know, Edward R. Murrow or even the Watergate investigation. You know, that's when the press was really the fourth estate. But then at some point, you know, we got a couple of problems. One is that, and I say this as a pretty far left guy, but news became so liberal that a lot of the right felt so disaffected that it would run to any light, even if it's behind a bug zapper, to go somewhere that spoke to them. So you had that problem. And then you also had, you know, I think that the things really started to come apart with the Gary Hart story when the Miami Herald decided,
that's the monkey business.
Yeah. I look back at that and I think, even though I'm a First Amendment lawyer, there are certain things I wish that the press would just say, we can, but we won't. And, you know, I like that the press didn't bother to report on John F. Kennedy's extramarital affairs, because who cares? You know, it didn't matter. And the Miami Herald was so badly wanted to be the next Watergate and wanted to have that salacious story. And it took down Gary Hart, but it also it meant that there was no longer that line of decorum that wasn't enforced by law, but was enforced by custom, and which gave us serious news. But now when the regular news is obsessed with a blowjob that Bill Clinton got, at what point, you know, where do we say, hold on, we got to take our job seriously again? And then you add the infinite diversity of the internet. You know, there was a time when if you wanted to have press, well, you needed to own a TV station or a radio station or a printing press. You had to be at least somewhat invested in it. Mm-hmm. Instead, now, a couple of crackpots can just go and, register a domain name, start putting out a show, and it can have all the trappings of CNN.
That makes me wonder if there is a legal distinction, right? We know that the First Amendment is all-encompassing, and there's only a few specific situations in which free speech is not protected. And so the question is there any legal distinction between legitimate news and non-legitimate news?
No. There isn't. And in fact, I got yelled at by a federal judge about this because I said that he didn't have constitutionally, he couldn't make that inquiry. And it's like, well, Article 3 means you don't get to tell a judge what he gets to think. But, judge yelled at you. But it was, the judge inquired, is your client actually a journalist? And I said, of course he is. He says, well, what evidence do you have of that? I said, I don't need evidence of that. You don't, constitutionally, you can't make that inquiry. Because you are. But we're now in a place where, I mean, heck, we're even different from the days when you had subscription-based internet access, because at least then somebody needed to have a credit card to get on the internet. And now the guy who's actually masturbating behind a dumpster right now can go to the public library and get on the internet.
Wait, you saw me?
Hey, it doesn't make you a bad person. By the way, we're getting lots of signups on our website that we made for that.
News from behind the dumpster.
But let's also remember that there is ethics. There's still ethics in journalism at the highest levels and at the levels that some people respect. Like, okay, maybe individuals do report if a president has an extramarital affair because they use the same reasoning that you did, Jay, that if a president, and I know Evan has said this too, that if a president is making those decisions, can they be trusted with other kinds of decisions? That this is not a private issue. It's actually veering into becoming a public issue. Yet there are rules about whether or not journalists should film or can film the president's children in different scenarios. And that's something that I think a lot of journalists still uphold. Yeah, there's paparazzi out there, but you don't see a front page cover of the New York Times of, the Obama kids outside of a place where they have given them permission to be filmed. And this is a standard that's still utilized because at a certain point, it doesn't matter for the populace. It's just an invasion of privacy.
Right. But, at some point, no one cares. At some point, because, really, I can criticize journalists all I want, but it's the market. We're buying it. It's going to sell papers. It's going to sell clicks. It's going to sell retweets.
Yeah. I don't think we can even talk anymore about whether or not it's okay to publish things because everything is out there now. It's like, as Mark said, everyone's a journalist now. It's all out there. I think it's really more of an issue of, for some outlets who are to hold themselves to a high standard of quality and ethics and sort of rise above the noise because they are doing that. And do we have high enough quality journalists out there to do like the real investigative reporting and get the real information out there, for those who want? I think we do, yeah.
We have two. Yeah. Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi.
Okay. I don't think they're the only two.
I do.
What about Jeremy Scahill?
I got to be honest, I'm not familiar. So maybe good. Maybe there's enough people to fill a three-roll Volvo. But other than that,
And the problem is a lot of them are independent and it's hard for them to get funding. Like investigative journalism is so expensive. I think that Frontline does it well. I think PBS has a good journalism arm and they do it very, very well. But it's super expensive and they can only churn out a new episode like once a month because of that.
Right. And by that time, they've been scooped 10 times by hacks.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Oh, yeah. But they're not trying to break news. That's the other thing. Like, they don't want to be first. They want to be right.
I think it'd be, if I wanted to fix it, I'd say we all got to go back to 14,000 baud dial-up internet.
Oh, boy, no.
Bob, what do you think of that?
No, thanks. If
we could go back to dial-up, I think it would make the world a lot better.
Yeah, but it's a feedback loop, though, because the journalists are reflecting the culture and driving the culture at the same time, right? That's always been the case. You know, mass media, they say, oh, we're just giving the people what they want. Yeah, you're actually kind of telling them what they want too. It's not that simple. And we've sort of just evolved our way into this mess that we're in. And I don't think there really is, I don't think anyone knows the way forward. At this point, I think it's just chaos. Everyone's waiting to see what's going to happen next.
No, it's like you have to choose a way forward for yourself. You know, I think you have to come up with a good strategy individually for not getting stuck in the chamber. Yeah,
as we all will. I mean, I like to consider myself to be a sophisticated consumer of media, but there are just some things that make me laugh so hard that I have to forward them, right? I am no better, man. I try to feel like I am, and I try to act like I am, and sometimes I just don't want to look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, oh my God, I forwarded that. But I mean, you know, but there are things I won't do. Like when I know that there's been, when they had the big fappening, you know, the release of all the celebrities' nudes that somebody had hacked.
You did not just call it that. That is the grossest thing ever.
Kara, when people have downloaded that, that's the name of the folder.
That is insane. But do you think, I wonder if that would pass muster though on iTunes explicit rating? Like, because we don't have an explicit rating. Can you say that word? Fappening? Okay.
But
go on.
I personally have, even though I actually would very much like to one day see Jennifer Lawrence naked, I have never looked at those photos because she didn't want them out there. And I'm going to respect that. Now, the fact that I am, you know, two eyeballs out of, 700 million eyeballs in America that didn't look at it probably doesn't change it any, but, you know, be the change you want to see in the world, said Gandhi, right?
My big concern about the trends in the media is that, and I think we all see this to some degree, it's like we're kind of evolving into two Americas based on the echo chambers that you live in, you know? It's like, it really does literally seem like people are living in different worlds, and those worlds are defined by the media that they consume, which are curated in order to cater to a specific worldview and ideology, which then just goes more and more and more extreme in that direction. Because again, you're creating a feedback loop. So, I mean, I have people in my life that really, you know, their reality is different than mine. It's just different. They have a completely different set of facts by which they are understanding the world.
Oh yeah. I mean, I try really hard to both challenge things I believe. Like I'm the president of the First Amendment Lawyers Association, and we're having a meeting in July, and I'm trying to find people who are anti-free speech to come talk to us. I want anti-porn activists, and I want people who think hate speech should be banned, and I'm trying to bring these people in, and I know I'm going to get like lynched for it, but every other meeting that we have, we sit around, we talk about how great it is that we're all so wonderful about protecting freedom of expression, but you know, sometimes you got to kind of think about where is the other side of it. Because when I look at, I mean, like Steve, your case, I'm proud of every single pixel in that case. I mean, there's not a bit of that. But I have other cases where I've looked at, you know, I've defended some people doing things that I would not have wanted them done to me. You know, people are invading other people's privacy, or, you know, there have been cases where somebody really did some real damage to somebody, and I had to stand there and say, but the Constitution protects it. I'm usually not so lucky as I have something. I have a case where I'm 100% on the Constitution side and believe 100% in the client. You know, there's always a little bit of a deviation, but I think we don't seek out people that challenge our beliefs enough. And that makes things not just an echo chamber, but less fun. Like, I started reading Breitbart, you know, a year ago. And man, I love it. Like, it's really, I think it's great. It's fit. And Milo Yiannopoulos, I love that guy. I think he's, I love that he just doesn't care. He'll just walk into a party and like, you know, and he'll just drop his gonads in the mashed potatoes and say, what do you got to drink?
Not literally, you know, yes.
Maybe.
Maybe.
You know, and I like that about him. And I've, You know, I've got friends who are just completely super right wing, born again Christians, and I can have the most wonderful conversations with them. And of course, you know, they're like, well, you're an idiot and you're going to hell. I'm like, okay, but you know, if that's true and you wind up there, will you still have a drink with me? And they're like, well, of course. I've been trying really hard, which has made a lot of my left wing friends mad because I'm trying to embrace the right wing people around me. And say that I get it. I get that you look at things differently. You know, I get that the coal mine jobs aren't coming back and Trump said that he's going to bring them back. But you know, like they know that's not going to happen, but they love that somebody pretended they cared. I mean, think about that. Like, you know, if you're happy to follow somebody because you know that they're going to screw you too, but at least they're pretending they care. It's like going to the strip club. I know the girl doesn't really like me, but I like she's pretending.
Pretending really well.
I'll pay good money for that, you know? And it's like, of course the girl doesn't really like me, but here, have $20 and tell me about how you're going to medical school.
Huh. Yeah, I do think that I agree with that. I think we should make more of an effort to try to understand and engage with people who disagree with us. You know, I think the part of the problem is how personal everyone takes it. You know, this isn't personal. It really isn't. We're all just trying to figure shit out and we're all wrong. You know, we're just wrong in different ways. So let's you might as well be nice to each other while we're disagreeing. Not that people don't have really harmful, hateful ideas that need to be opposed vigorously. Absolutely. And there are some con artists and assholes out there. Absolutely. But most people aren't that way. Most people are just think differently than you. I get the most upset, like when I hear people either on the right or the left, and I have people in my life that are as far right as you can get and as far left as you can get. And when I hear them say, oh, the other side are evil, I'm like, no, that is absolutely wrong. They're not evil people. They're just like you. They just have a different set of information that's being crammed into their head. That's it. You know, and I don't know why it's so hard for people to realize that, but that's a problem.
They're playing us all, you know, like one of the saddest moments I realized that we were this bad was, you know, back in 1988, I went to a Klan rally to protest against it and with a couple of friends. And, you know, I still have on my mantle a picture of us kind of standing there like little punk rock kids that were there to protest against the Klan. And one of the guys in that picture put out a call, said, hey, I'm going to go down to Philadelphia where that Klan rally was to go canvass for Hillary Clinton. Does anybody have a place I can crash? And I called a friend of mine who has worn a Make America Great hat every single day since they came out and will probably be buried in one. But I said, hey, can you put my friend up? He says, sure. I said, I got to let you know he's coming to canvass for Hillary Clinton. He says, I don't care. He says, look, Tell me what time his plane comes in. He can, I got an extra car he can have. I'll set up the guest room for him. Tell me what kind of beer he drinks. I'm like, perfect, right? And then, you know, I went to my friend and I said, hey, I got you a place to stay. And, he disowned me because first he was appreciative and then he asked, he says, I'm sorry I didn't ask this before, but is this guy a Trump supporter? And I said, well, yeah, but who cares? And, he hasn't talked to me since.
Wow, that's harsh.
And it was like, wow, man, you know, I got 30 years of being like, you know, an activist with you. We lived together, you know, we were in car accidents together. Yeah. And now, you know, and the thing is, who better to try to persuade? You can sit there at that guy's table and talk to each other.
The thing is, I think it's a very good perspective to have. And I remember like talking to one of my in-laws, and they were visiting, and Perry was over, right? And Perry was very Republican, and you know that came up in the conversation, and she like laughed and said, "I guess I always." It just occurred to her that she always assumes that everyone's a Democrat, like she'd never met a Republican, so she just has this baseline assumption that everyone that she knows is a Democrat. It's like, yeah, that's how can you have any kind of perspective when you're that sheltered? Interesting. I was very interested. I like half the people I know are Republican, half are Democrat. You can't, and they're all good people. They're all fine. They just think differently. They just have different opinions. But yeah, I think it's crazy how angry and personal it has become. But I think partly because people are scared, and I think legitimately so, because I think Trump is legitimately dangerous, not because of his ideology, but because he's incompetent. But don't confuse that with what side of the spectrum he's on. He would be just as incompetent if he decided to run as a Democrat. You know what I'm saying?
And we didn't even know what he would have run as at the beginning, like because his ideas were kind of all over the place before he ever ran. Yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm not scared of him, mostly because I believe in separation of powers. And, you know, from what I've seen, yeah, he says some pretty crazy things. But, you know, he's also the first politician to actually have the government scale back on surveillance of Americans. And that stops – that's the brakes that stop things from going too haywire.
Yeah, and we've seen that. And we've seen that.
And I'm confident – that the system will slow him down to the point that it can, to the point that we're not going to have any revolutionary changes.
Yeah, but I agree with your basic premise. This is what I've been saying from the beginning, is that I just have to have faith in the system, you know, the separation of powers, as well as just it takes thousands of people to run the government. And so hopefully the adults will sort of keep things in check. And I think that's at least from reading a lot of the pundits, they're saying that's basically what's happening, is that, yeah, the adults are running things and, you know, he's running off at the mouth and on Twitter still. But, you know, he's not the dictator. He's not running, you know, this country like a dictatorship, and that built-in checks and balances is keeping things a little bit on an even keel. Doesn't mean that, you know, he can't get us into trouble, but I think it's not. Yeah, it's any.
It's not not apocalyptic.
But the Fourth, yeah, Reich is not. Yeah, it was never a worry. All right, Mark, I think we got to wrap this up. Any final thoughts?
Stay tuned for the next chapter in your case.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know,
everything about you.
I don't know how much you want to say about that. We won our first appeal. Yeah. We have one more appeal left. And there may be some other stuff after that as well. I don't know if we want to even, you know, hint at that, but.
No, I mean, I'll talk about what's in the public record. You know, we won at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, resoundingly. Yes. It was a beautiful decision that really reinforced a lot of, First Amendment principles. So, you know, Steve, there's two ways to live forever. You can get a disease named after you or a court case. So,
yep.
Well, I think
I'll take this one.
Yeah, this is better. You know, I don't know, maybe novella disease is a thing that makes you like superhuman. So it might be a good thing. So there has been now, Tabinnik has now petitioned to the Supreme Court for a writ of mandamus, which is it's a weird thing. I don't want to talk too much about it, but I'll just say it's weird. And I'm not expecting that to go anywhere. And then we are, he's certainly going to seek review at the Supreme Court.
Wow.
Now, only a very tiny percentage of cases get to the Supreme Court, and I'm not putting much money on this one.
Mark, if that happens, like, how long would it take to get a final notice that it's not going to happen?
700 years. I mean, no, it'll probably be sometime this summer, and then, you know, when that happens – if there are aliens, we'll be appealing to the intergalactic body that
Galactic Federation. Yeah. Right.
Before you build your bypass through Earth, we'd like you to review this.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mark. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just three regular news items this week. You ready?
Yep.
See.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. New research finds that being bilingual increases one's ability to estimate the subjective passage of time. Item number two, in a recent large study, social smokers had as much of an increase in cardiovascular risk factors as daily smokers. And item number three, scientists report in a recent study that honeybee hives are healthier in the presence of traditional agriculture compared to to non-agricultural areas. Kara, go first.
New research finds that being bilingual increases one's ability to estimate the subjective passage of time. What? Why would that matter? at all. I do know that one thing I know about language is that even the languages that sound really, really, really fast, like Spanish, they tend to use more words. And so on average, any given language, if you measure how to get the same point across, it takes the same amount of time.
Ah, I love it.
Yeah, I do know that. I saw some interesting research about that. But that has nothing to do with this, so I'm going to skip it. In a recent large study, social smokers had as much of an increase in cardiovascular risk factors as daily smokers. That sounds crazy to me, but God, listen to how it's worded. As much of an increase in risk factors, not an increase in like cardiovascular damage. Okay. And then scientists report in a recent study that honeybee hives are healthier in the presence of traditional agriculture compared to non-agricultural areas. Ugh, crap. I would think they'd be healthier if they have more flowering plants nearby. Maybe agricultural areas bring in more flowering plants, but traditional agriculture is like monoculture now and actually probably has less flowering plants depending on what the... I'm just going to say that one's the fiction because it seems the most obviously right. I don't know. I'm going to say that because traditional agriculture clears huge swaths of land and only a single plant grows there, oftentimes the bees have less diversity of pollinating plants. Or plants to pollinate, so they have a harder time keeping their hive healthy. Whatever.
Okay, Jay.
All right, this first one that says being bilingual increases your ability to estimate the subjective passage of time. God, I'm stuck on this one. I haven't even really looked at the other two. It's really interesting. I can't think of any reason what the mechanism would be to help you to give you a better subjective passage of time. I don't understand that. So I'm just going to go to the next one here. The social smokers had as much of an increase in cardiovascular risk factors as daily smokers. I mean, yeah, I mean, the social thing, you know, I don't know what the parameters are when he says social. How often a week is that or whatever? Is it once a day, twice a week, whatever? Maybe it's because smokers will hang around with other smokers, and even though they're not smoking, they're still breathing in. I think that one is science. This last one here, scientists report that in a recent study, the honeybee hives are healthier in the presence of traditional agriculture compared to non-agricultural areas. I agree with that. Of course, I agree with that. The first one about the subjective passage of time when you're bilingual, that's not science. That is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, this bilingual one is really, really puzzling. How does it affect the subjective passage of time?
Right. The
whole thing sounds subjective. ¿Cómo está? I don't know about that one. Jay said that one's a fiction. I think I'm leaning towards that one being fiction. The social smokers having as much of an increased risk of cardiovascular risk. I don't know how do they define social smoker? I guess what? Once a couple times a week as opposed to people smoking a pack a day? That's a huge range. There's a lot of wiggle room in that one, I think. That one could be it. The last one about the honeybees. I wonder if it has to do with... Do honeybees have predators of any kind that traditional agriculture would protect them against that non-agriculture wouldn't protect them against? Maybe it's something along those lines. I have a feeling that one's... I think that one I can kind of grasp the best, I think, of the three of these. But I'll go with Jay. I think it's the bilingual one for some reason. There's something not right there about the passage of time, and I can't put my finger on it. So I'll have to say that one's the fiction.
And Bob.
Yeah, I had the opposite reaction. The bilingual one makes sense to me in terms of affecting the subjective passage of time, and I can't put my finger on why, but I just feel that kind of makes sense that would be a benefit. It's just so beneficial to have, you know, the more languages you know in a lot of ways. But the cardiovascular fitness, social smoker, what does that mean? I mean, I could see if you're a social smoker, it could be a pack. Say a pack over the course of a social evening, if you just kind of go to town. So I'm gonna go with Kara and say that something about the bee one's kind of rubbing me wrong, and say that's fiction.
Interesting.
All right, so we got an even split. All right, sounds good. So that means you all agree on the middle one.
Oh boy.
You all agree that in a recent large study, social smokers had as much of an increase in cardiovascular risk factors as daily smokers. You all think that one is science, and that one is science. No sweep.
Right. Interesting.
All right.
Means I got
all
half
right.
of you. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Not that surprising. The strength of this study was that it was large. You know, they looked at 39,555 people. The weakness is that they were going by self-report. So
that sucks.
How did they define social smokers? People defined themselves as social smokers versus a daily smoker. So,
all right.
I said regular smoker, you smoke every day. That's just part of your daily routine. Social smokers only smoke in certain situations, like when they are out at a bar or when they are with certain people. And so it's obviously very highly variable. It's also possible that current social smokers were previous daily smokers, and that wasn't evaluated either. So the information about the individuals was not great, but dividing people, the people were actually divided into three groups: non-smokers, daily smokers, and social smokers. The daily and social smokers had increased hypertension and cholesterol. Those are the risk factors compared to the non-smokers, but there was no difference between those two groups. So it was just as bad in the social smoker group as in the daily smoker group. So it's one study. No one study is perfect. We always say that. But what this information suggests is a couple of things. First, a lot of people who are social smokers, when you ask, do you smoke? They say no. For whatever reason, you know, is that self-deception or are they embarrassed or whatever? And so the authors were saying, yeah, so when you're taking a medical history, a social history, you can't just ask, are you a smoker? Because they may say, well, I don't smoke every day, so no, I'm not a smoker. You have to ask, like, when's the last time you used any tobacco? Do you use any tobacco at all? You know, I have to make sure you're capturing those people. And also it suggests that even occasional smoking could also still be a high risk. So this is all for cardiovascular disease. They weren't looking at things like lung cancer, which, you know, that tends to be more proportional to how much you smoke. You know, the more you smoke, the higher your risk. But in terms of cardiovascular risk, it may not, you know, be proportional. It may be that even a little bit of smoking and you get the risk of that. All right, where should we go to next? Let's go, I guess, back to number one. New research finds that being bilingual increases one's ability to estimate the subjective passage of time. Jay and Evan, you both think this one is the fiction. Bob and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
The fiction.
It is the fiction.
Oh, good. What the hell?
This is a hard one this
week.
That
was really tough.
It was. Like, These were weird. This is a hard one. So, yeah, I just made that up. But let me tell you what the... real study that inspired it showed. So what they did look at, this is also interesting, very, very interesting. They tried to look at the effect that language has on the perception of time. And what they were looking for is the effect of interference on our ability to estimate time. So, which is a way of trying to figure out if how language affects our internal conceptualization of time. So here's the thing. Some languages, like English and Swedish, conceptualize time linguistically in terms of length, right? You do something for a short time or a long time, but not all languages do that. Other languages, like Portuguese or Spanish, conceptualize language as size. So they have like big time and small time, or much time and small time, right? So
yeah, mucho tiempo.
They use words that are more related to volume and size and not to length. So, okay, so they said, okay, does that really affect how people think about time? That was the question of the research. So they looked at people who were bilingual in both Swedish and Spanish, and they gave them a test where they had to estimate how long a video was playing for. The video, however, also was showing either like a barrel filling up with fluid or a line getting longer and longer. And that was sort of incongruous with how much time was going by. Like, so you could see like the barrel could have filled up quickly to make it seem like it was a short amount of time, or the line, you know, could have been moving more slowly. So when they were prompted to do the test in Swedish, where length is the, you know, the metaphor for the duration of time, then the length image had more of an interference with their ability to estimate time. Whereas when they were prompted to estimate the time in Spanish, then the volume image was more of an interference in their ability to estimate time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so
it kind of, it was like they were thinking of time in terms of volume when they were thinking in Spanish, and they were thinking of time in terms of length when they were thinking in Swedish. So it also implies that people who are bilingual, and this is in line with other research, are flexible thinkers. They're more flexible than monolingual people because they're constantly flipping back and forth between different languages, and that these languages actually affect how we construct and think about the world, you know. In this case, you know, a metaphor for time either being length or size, which is fascinating. It sounds so weird, like to us, like thinking of small time, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds so weird. I mean, how could you think of time as being small? What does that mean?
Short
makes perfect sense. I mean, that's it, right? I totally get that. Like, and it's funny to think that if you were raised speaking Portuguese, you know, short time is weird to you and small time makes perfect sense. Is that interesting?
It is, and now I get it. And that's what I couldn't think of when I was trying to figure out what was going on here.
Yeah, but it doesn't – just being bilingual doesn't make you better at estimating time. I just made that part up. Bastard. All right, which means that scientists report in a recent study that honeybee hives are healthier in the presence of traditional agriculture compared to non-agricultural areas is science. And so essentially what's going on here, there are two factors affecting the honeybee health. One is pesticides, which has a negative effect. There's no question that honeybees are going to get contaminated with some of the pesticides, and some of them will get enough of a dose that it will harm or kill them. So pesticides definitely have a negative effect. However, the presence of agriculture, which is a lot of plants, provides a food source for the honeybees, and the benefit to the hive of having that reliable food source vastly outweighs the negative effect of the pesticide. So the hives were healthier, were bigger, had more numbers. They reproduce more quickly when they have that steady food source supplied by the agriculture, even more than any negative effect from the pesticide, which is kind of reassuring, you know, that honeybees can adapt and do well even in our, though we've converted most of our land to farmland, yeah, they're still going to survive. That's nice to know. Doesn't mean that pesticides are off the hook, though. No one is saying that we don't have to think about what pesticides we're using and how much and consider that impact. They're not off the hook. It just means that, you know, there's other factors are involved as well.
It's a little weird to me. Like, did they say what agricultural plants they were near?
They just looked across
any
the board.
Agriculture.
Yeah, they didn't break it down. So I guess there's enough of them are a nectar source that.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, even though fields may be monocultured, just the presence of agriculture because it's so dense. There's just so many. One field of flowering plants could be so much more nectar than you're going to get in the wild. You know, that's basically what they're saying.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, makes sense. All right, Jay and Evan, good job.
Oh.
Of course.
That was a tough one.
It was a weird week. Okay.
Yeah.
But you guys all kind of hit upon the fact that, God, what's the mechanism of the bilingual thing at the time? Yeah, that was the thing. Yeah, there wasn't one. That was the bit. Yeah,
Something's missing. It made me angry because I couldn't think of one thing, you know? It was just odd.
Yeah.
Good job, Steve.
All right, Evan, give us a quote this week.
Okay, here we go. We must trust to nothing but facts. These are presented to us by nature and cannot deceive. We ought in every instance to submit our reasoning to the test of experiment and never to search for truth but by the natural road of experiment and observation. Antoine Lavoisier, from the book Elements of Chemistry. He was, obviously French nobleman, chemist, central to the 18th century chemical revolution, and had a large influence on both the history of chemistry and the history of biology. Do you know how he died?
He died of moita.
Practically. He was guillotined as part of the French Revolution. Yeah.
Evan, you knew this guy, right?
Oh, absolutely. He and I were buds.
So what did he do to get his head cut off? Like, what do you got to do back then?
Yeah,
glove or something?
They arrested all former tax gatherers, and apparently he was one of those. He was lots of different things, you know, but he was definitely, part of... the aristocracy and the government, you know, before the revolution, and they threw him in the lot with a bunch of other people who were said to have basically plundered the state, you know, and stole all the money dry from the people. He, along with 27 co-defendants, lost their lives as part of the guillotine. Now, there was an appeal to spare his life so he could continue his experiments, but it was cut short by the judge. His appeal was cut short, and the judge said the following: "The Republic has no need for scientists or chemists. The course of justice cannot be delayed." What a sad thought. What a horrible thought that is. I mean, geez, talk about... Woo.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the guys at that time, a scientist at the time, when we were just figuring out the whole chemistry thing. Like, really, like, just the notion that there are elements and they combine with each other and they do stuff. You know, I mean, that was like really the fundamental basics of chemistry. He was hammering that out. Joseph Priestley, I think, was the other guy that he worked with.
Oh, yeah.
It was all alchemy before that.
Yeah.
That's right. Basically. Magic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Surely. Steve.
My pleasure, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.